Today's show is sponsored in part by ManageEngine and their OpManager network management software. OpManager integrates NetFlow monitoring, configuration management, firewall log management, IP address management, and more, all in a single product. Go to opmanager.com/packetpushers to get a free 30-day trial. Today's Packet Pushers is brought to you in part by Viptela. Viptela is going to be hosting an SD-WAN mixer on October the 24th in New York City. If you're in town for the ONUG conference or just hanging around New York and would like to see us, we hope to see you there. Look for more information from that on at Packet Pushers or at viptela.com. So, Greg.
Yes,
Mr. Banks.
I don't know why I call you Mr. Banks when you say Greg like that.
Because I demand that kind of respect, buddy. That's how it works.
It's weird, isn't it? The sort of things that you say. Like, I was listening to some of our shows recently. I've been doing a lot of walking. I'm on a fitness kicker, right? Probably won't last for long, but anyway. I've been listening to some of our shows, and I'm realizing how set in our ways we've become on these shows, and some of the language that we use is just patterned over and over and over.
Yeah, there's a cadence and a rhythm that you fall into, especially with this kind of job. I mean, we've been in places where people have joked at us or poked fun at us because we slip into the radio voice mode. All of a sudden, we can just kind of like turn it on. There it is. And all of a sudden, the radio voice is there. So before the show, we were talking about moving everything to cloud, the notion of enterprises taking all their stuff from their data centers and moving it somewhere. I mean, we've seen some of that with colos, of course. Everybody does that, but that's different. We're talking about actually moving their services off to cloud in a variety of ways. And my flavor of that has been researching serverless. Serverless being the idea of you don't have to have infrastructure to serve applications up. You use someone else's infrastructure. So from your perspective, it's serverless. In a few different ways that that's happening. Amazon Web Services, of course, their Lambda service, and a variety of other concepts in there that would allow you to build serverless applications where you're running functions up in the cloud, as opposed to having you're not even running an instance of a service up in AWS. You're just using them to generate a function. And then even beyond that, you've got all these platform as a service providers like Heroku, for example. And you as an application developer look at all these different services that are out there that can do different things for you. Serve up images that can respond to queries with data because they're a platform that's got all this stuff. And then you just basically have to write glue code. You're putting code together that offers a presentation layer, correlates the data, makes it pretty, serves it up to your users, and you did all that without ever standing up a server just somewhere that is hosting that glue code.
So like Node.js, if you drop your JavaScript code on a Node.js instance and then upload some, if you've got images or other sort of files, you just upload them into an appropriate directory and away you go. And it's basically instead of, you know, building a VM and then loading the code and building a server and, you know, or a container that has a web server in it and then uploading your code to the container and all that sort of stuff, all you're doing is putting the code somewhere in Amazon and they charge you for the CPU cycles you burn to run the code.
Which is where that Lambda and functionality comes in, because a lot of folks are finding they can save a ton of money if they redesign the application to run a function rather than burning CPU cycles on a full-blown server instance.
Which is funny because that's when Google Cloud first came out, or Google Compute first came out. That's the way they came out. And everybody went, ah, that makes no sense. Google, stupid, Google. And that's exactly the way their first product is. And they've been coming down towards EAS ever since. So they went from, just to run the code to containers, now to running infrastructure as a service type, you know, containers. And now they're building PaaS stuff on the side. But the odd thing is that everybody goes, oh, AWS is amazing for inventing serverless, blah, blah, blah. But the point is that Google invented it 5 years ago and Amazon's just catching up. Funny.
The question then becomes with all of this moving to the cloud stuff. I mean, there's two sides to this. One is, it's nice. You don't have your own physical facility anymore and so on. And all the network engineers listening to this are going, crap, where'd my network go? Because the data center's gone now. Gah.
And where's my job going to go? Right? Because do you remember a couple of years ago we were talking about where's the next generation of network engineers going to come from? You remember having that discussion?
Well, what it means to be a network engineer has changed so much, yeah. And then and exactly where would they come from, or is that even going to be a thing in the long haul? Will you be a network engineer, or will you have networking as part of your skill set that includes a lot of other things?
Yeah, I actually don't know. I think, you know, the thing is that the enterprise has been depopulating itself, and I've talked before about my pet theory is that vendors have been encouraging customers to get rid of their staff so they can shift the spending. Like IT spending's never gone down, but the total number of staff in IT has been vanishingly small as we've gotten rid of headcount, right? And we've sort of gotten to the point where we don't have enough staff to even operate the infrastructures that we have, but we're still spending more and more and more on capital-intensive programs. So in a sense, I sort of see cloud as a reaction to that overdoing that trend of buy more and more expensive stuff so that I've got 10 or 20 years worth of capacity, like buying extra capacity that I don't need, over-specifying the hardware, or, you know, I'm going to deploy this SAP and I only want to do it once, so I'm going to buy enough hardware for it to run 10 years without ever touching it again. Or, you know, that's pretty much where your experience is as well as mine, isn't it?
Well, it's a reaction to that, but I think we're also seeing companies that are moving things to the cloud for those reasons, but then moving it back because of the loss of control.
Yes. So there's a few things there. You move it back for lots of reasons. Like my overwhelming hypothesis for moving to the cloud is that you're poor. Like your company is not very profitable, and finding capital that will sustain you for 10, you know, to build a piece of something for 10 years, like your IT infrastructure, is not something that you want to do, or your management's fundamentally incompetent. A bit 50-50 between the two, right? Because it's always very seductive to sit there and say, you know what, IT is not a key part of our business. We're not technologists. We're not very good at IT. So let's just outsource all of that. But if there's one lesson that we've learned over and over and over, is that people who sit there and say, that's not my core business, and outsource something, and we know we've learned from outsourcing in IT enough over the last 10 years that outsourcing is 95% of the time a miserable failure. Like my experience of outsourcing is it never, ever, ever works for anything more complicated than cleaning toilets.
No one cares about your business as much as you care about your business. And as soon as you outsource that responsibility, you're giving it over to people who care about the money you spend with them, but not so much about your infrastructure and what you actually need. And then oftentimes the help you think you're getting that's supposedly expert is not expert. They're inferior quality, very often.
If you're very lucky, they're as expert as you are.
Yes. That's the reality of that.
Yeah. I'll never forget the time I was working for an outsourcer who then outsourced the WAN to another company who then outsourced the WAN to a company in India. And I was brought in, something had gone wrong and they couldn't work out what it was. And I came in to have a look at it, and somebody had been doing EIGRP load balancing. And as you know, when you try to load balance using EIGRP, you actually have to have multiple hops. You can't do it at the first hop, right? But this person just didn't know and had just gone and configured everything like CCNA level, and it just, and then nobody tested it, so it didn't work. It wasn't load balancing, and it didn't even fail over redundantly because they'd made an error in the configuration. That's outsourcing.
So if we take that outsourcing notion to public cloud, you're really outsourcing your infrastructure to public cloud, or from a serverless notion to platform as a service to people that can execute your code for you effectively. Then how long does that paradigm last? It's going to work for some folks, but I've been watching videos from Serverless Conf. So if you just if you're interested in these videos, just look for a cloud.guru, and they have a bunch of videos archived in there from Serverless Conf in New York City 2016. It sounds from a developer's perspective, oh, this is amazing. I can just get all these functions here and execute them, and I pay them some fee for this service, and it's awesome. I don't have to have my own infrastructure. I don't have to deal with all those friggin' ops people and infrastructure people to provision stuff for me. It just off it goes. But then the reality of that is, and what happens when that platform is a service you are paying to use their service? What happens when they aren't having a good day? Because invariably, they won't have a good day. Or it doesn't mean that you don't have to consider the impact to your application if that service fails. And so therefore, you need to leverage that service in a way that has redundancy and resiliency built in. You know, you're running a query against them. You're doing an API call. And what happens if the region you're hitting goes away? Do you have enough with them, enough of a service that you've bought with them so that you have a place to fail over to. And this came out in ServerlessConf because the developers think it's all easy, and then the people with operations background are raising the flag and going, yeah, but it isn't that easy. You still have to think about proper infrastructure design and operations, which then begs the question, you've outsourced all of this stuff to these folks, you know, how good is the service that they're offering you really? And at what point do you go, you know, by the time I architect this thing properly so that the services I'm taking advantage of have failover and resiliency and redundancy and the performance level I'm looking for and SLAs, should I just bring that back in-house? You know, that's actually a real question.
Well, so we saw Dropbox do that recently, right? So Dropbox has always been, well, they've always been a hybrid cloud play. So they've always had, you know, core business apps, the web front end, the customer part, the accounting and all that sort of stuff. Their key apps have actually always been in a private cloud that they ran themselves. But their storage has always been in Amazon, and various other parts of services are in Amazon. So certain databases and message queues and stuff like that has been in Amazon. And just recently they moved all that into the private cloud. And, you know, we still don't actually know the reason, but my guess would be is, A, Amazon was one of their biggest competitors or had the potential to become a big competitor to Dropbox, and B, it was cheaper to do it themselves than it was, you know, and now you're at scale, but keep in mind that even at modest scale or small size, you can go and buy a hyperconverged system like, you know, a Nutanix or one of the Cisco hyperconverged systems or a HPE or a Dell hyperconverged system and drop it on premises a rack at a time and get exactly the same feat. Like, that's exactly what clouds do. Like, they buy pre-built racks that rock up on their doorstep, all pre-built, right? And that rack is a storage rack or a compute rack, or they're functional, but they're designed a particular way. If you're buying a hyperconverged rack, you can literally buy a rack of stuff which is cloud function. It's ready to go as a cloud piece of hardware.
The question then, if I, you know, am investing in all of that stuff, is, let's look at it from a business perspective. You know, where do I draw the line between what makes sense to outsource, public cloud, platform as a service, versus bringing it back in? Yep, I can buy racks, as you put it, it rocks up on my doorstep, I roll it into the data center, power it on, and in theory, it's all going to work. I still need bodies to deal with all of that. Where is the line drawn that I, as a business, am keeping people on staff who are experts in this? So let me go back to another conversation I had here, just to set some tone. We recorded, I don't think it's published as of this recording, but we recorded a show with Adam Jacob, CTO at Chef, over on Datanauts. And he made the point that people are fearful of automation because automation is like, oh my gosh, my job's going to go away. And he said, no, your job doesn't go away. It actually, automation just frees you up to do the things that have been on your list forever that you never seem to get to because you're doing all the crappy work. Okay, so that's one thing, automation of infrastructure we have. If you try to automate that completely away and go, I just don't want the cost at all, poof, it's gone. Again, where as a business do we draw that line? So let me tie this into networking. One of the things that's been fascinating to me about outsourcing all of this public cloud is you have just given up your latency and your control over path, by and large, to a bunch of people you don't own and don't have a business relationship with. People, a bunch of infrastructure, I should say, that you don't own and don't have a business relationship with, right? I can't guarantee an SLA of my application anymore. That's gone. I cannot guarantee that. And so as a business, I'm giving up control in a very major way over my applications and what I'm delivering to my customers for maybe speed, maybe for agility, maybe so developers and operations people don't have to talk so much and you can just kind of make that butting of heads go away. You know, as a business, I think there's short-sightedness for certain businesses if they just think I'm going to dump everything up in the cloud.
I mean, that's certainly the thing. There are no guarantees in the cloud, literally, but there's no guarantees with your existing infrastructure, right? Take your average Cisco product comes with a 90-day hardware warranty only. That's it. right? And there's no guarantee that it will actually work. So any IT product that you buy as a, for a private cloud is not actually guaranteed to work because the vendors say, you know, force majeure, acts of God, these products, you know, and computer software sales are fundamentally, there's no liability in any way, shape or form because it's so complicated that you can't take it to a court of law and say, this is negligence on the part of the vendor. The vendor can just say, bugs are a part of normal operation. The customer has to live with them, right?
And we know that to be a case. I mean, it sounds pretty, you mentioned Cisco, so maybe it sounds like we're picking on Cisco, but that's not really the case. This is with any vendor. Yeah, the reality of owning your own infrastructure is not that, well, I just de-risked that. I now own the infrastructure and I have smart people that can help me fix it and I can fall back on the vendor when it breaks. Well, that's a very fair point, Greg, that is not exactly true because the code is bloody awful and we know this. We hear this all the time. We just got emails from people complaining about a particular product saying, you guys got to warn people off of this stuff. I mean, this is 3 years into the product cycle and it's terrible.
He's had it for 9 months and in 9 months he's found 8 bugs, none of which have yet been fixed by the vendor.
And this is from a guy that we've communicated with before, we know is a networking expert and is just frustrated to no end by these. And as I've kicked around asking other people about this same product line, some people have had okay experiences, but several other people have just been, you know, buggy, some weird behaviors, some strange things. Again, going back to the point, just because you own the infrastructure and you have smart people that can work on it and a support contract with the vendor doesn't mean your uptime is necessarily going to be any better. So that is a fair point. Let's take a break from the show today to talk about our sponsor, OpManager from ManageEngine. OpManager is a complete network management platform for network and server monitoring, bandwidth analysis, IP address and switch port management, configuration management, and more, all available as a single .exe file. OpManager covers a great deal of your IT operations. We're going to mention just a couple of key features today. The first is monitoring of network health and performance. This includes the features you expect from network monitoring, including bandwidth monitoring, router and switch device monitoring, and integration with Cisco IPSLA, as well as NBAR. With OpManager, you can even build custom dashboards, allowing you to make that knock view that everybody likes, or the one with the big green light and the thumbs up, so your manager sleeps well. The second feature we'll mention today is OpManager's ability to handle flow data in the Bandwidth Manager tool. Many different flow formats are supported, including firewall logs, IP fix, and NetFlow, which can tell you which specific applications are consuming your bandwidth. And the cool part is when you see a problem in the Bandwidth Manager, you can jump straight to the Configuration Manager to fix it. And hey, it's multi-vendor. But you want more! Okay, OpManager can pair flow data with user metadata so that you know not only the source IP of those flows, but also the human being attached to them. This means you can do things like tweak a firewall policy with user-centric rules in reaction to the flows being seen blocking bad behavior. OpManager, it can scale to 50,000 devices or 1 million interfaces and includes workflow automation for troubleshooting and remediation and colorized WAN links for easy performance alerting. You also get a customizable dashboard with multiple views for operators and managers, and all these features are available as a part of a single installation, which makes OpManager easy to install and evaluate. So go to opmanager.com/packetpushers and get a free 30-day trial. And thanks to ManageEngine for being a sponsor. And now back to the show.
Cloud has its own challenges, right? So right now you've got a really difficult thing where if you go to AWS and start learning AWS networking or AWS and you end up mastering the AWS APIs and then your company decides to do business with Azure because you want to have a multi-vendor strategy, which is smart and wise and practical, right?
Or Azure just gives you functionality that AWS doesn't, which is, you know, another buying decision there.
Yep. But they also use fundamentally different language for the same thing. So if you're creating, say, for example, if you're creating a VPN inside of AWS versus Azure, Azure says the local site is in the customer data center and the remote site is Azure. Right? That's completely mind-bendingly stupid to do it the wrong way around, but they're riding the IPsec tunnel as though it's from the customer point of view. So the customer's local data center is their data center, not Azure. But you're configuring it in Azure, so you have to invert your thinking. Does that make sense?
Mm.
Whereas if you go to AWS, you can create a static point-to-point IPsec tunnel, but you can't create a dynamic one. And it doesn't call them endpoints. It has this whole different language, and the whole UI is extremely, you know, blah, blah, blah. And you've then got to get over the hurdle of how do I get my first configuration out? Because the only way you can really do the configurations repeatedly is to do APIs, right? So you can't just, like, if you want to replicate how to configure a VPN 20 times, you can just, you know, the way we do it today is we take the text and we paste it into the router 20 times and change some IP addresses, the copy pasta, right? But if you want to do that in AWS, you have to use the APIs and write a script that's going to punch the APIs the same way.
And as you say, it's not just different terms for different that the different public clouds use for the same thing with each other. It's also that there's different levels of functionality there. And so there's been talk of, well, we just need an abstraction API that makes all these public clouds look the same. But then the point has been raised, just like it's been raised by networking vendors when we're talking about APIs to abstract networking equipment. Yeah, sure, there's a lowest common denominator of an API that we could write, but if that's very limiting, because there's other things that these platforms can do, there's other things that these public clouds can do that other ones can't, and so you can't just write one API that everybody's going to call so you can replicate the same functionality. All you're going to get is a very base level of functionality and then give up all of the differentiation between the different public clouds, which is not what anybody wants. So you can't win there either.
No. No. And then all of a sudden they start introducing various features like proprietary features. So load balancing, AWS's approach to load balancing is radically different to the way anybody else thinks of it. And how a developer came up with that idea, that language, it doesn't make sense to me. I can't get my mind. Like when you work with any vendor's load balancer, they've all got a particular grammar or there's a mode of thinking. And once you click into that mode, you can pretty much configure anything at the CLI. Fair? You've written in multiple CLIs over the years.
Oh yes, absolutely.
You know, NetF5, NetScreen. I've worked on A10s. I've worked on Citrix NetScalers. I've worked on
several different flavors of Cisco. Anyway, yeah.
And after a while, you get there's some grammar and you can just iterate. Once you get proficient at the CLI grammar, you just move your way forward. But AWS's grammar is deeply inconsistent because it's API centric. And it just makes the hurdle extremely difficult to get going. At least I find that AWS networking makes very little sense as a veteran. Now, that's possibly my fault. I'll take that criticism because I've spent time on it and right now I'm not doing that. But, you know, to me, it doesn't seem like AWS is worth investing my time in quite yet. It's on my agenda, but not yet.
Well, again, tying this all back to networking and infrastructure, I am not convinced that the long term of the world is going to be serverless, although I think it's going to have a big impact, nor am I convinced that everything's moving to public cloud, although that's obviously having an impact because there's so much more at stake here than simply, this is an easy ROI. As soon as I can get all my applications that they run in the cloud, then great, I can just shut down all this infrastructure and get rid of these people. The business decision is more complex than that, for sure. Well, you did a show with Greg Nierman not that long ago about private cloud, yeah?
Yes, I did. And, you know, he's a big believer in a private cloud. And I think also private cloud, the thing that most people don't, they're only looking at what private clouds that we have today. So they're all enterprise IT. They're largely office-centric. They're largely focused on human resources and accounting and some sort of key line of business app, right? It'll be your data center is basically full of that sort of stuff, just office productivity stuff, right? Fair?
Mm-hmm.
Right? But I think there's this whole new generation of private clouds coming where you're going to see in the same way that, say, back in the late 90s, we saw the proliferation of desktops. And so then we started to need servers so that the desktops could share data. So we started to build Novell NetWare, then Windows NT. And that was the emergence of a new market. What we're seeing with, and I'm going to use the word IoT in its loosest possible term, with the plethora of sensors that you're now seeing, you're going to see offices populated with IoT sensors for doors and air conditioning and attendance systems and, you know, all these things that have never been done before, clock on, clock off, how many desks are being used, how much electricity is the office using because you're paying per kilowatt now instead of some fixed, you know, electricity meters or whatever. you're going to see factories with thousands of sensors in them, all storing data and analyzing the data. They're also going to be connected to the cloud, and go, but they're not going to upload all that data to the cloud because it's just too much sensors, right? And the feedback loops to be too long. By the time you send the data to the cloud, you know, the activity that you need to do, if you need to shut down a machine, like within a half a second because it's doing something wrong, you can't wait for the cloud to receive that data, process it, and then send you back an answer and say, if it comes back a minute later and the machine's just mangled itself to death and, exit one $5 million machine and your factory's down for 3 months while it's repaired.
I took a briefing from a company called Foghorn that addresses that exact concern. This is where the whole fog computing thing becomes real, which I think makes an interesting point here about the network. When we talk about shifting workloads up to public cloud and, we don't have data center facilities we got to maintain, you still have a network infrastructure that's got to be maintained. A big wireless infrastructure for the access layer, a big campus infrastructure to interconnect buildings. And as you brought up, IoT becoming increasingly real now and the need for local compute for timeliness of decisions, you've still got a local infrastructure that must be maintained by somebody. And the larger the organization is, the more likely they're going to still need network engineers on staff to make that happen. So again,
So on one hand, I can see that resellers are in trouble, right? Because they depend on the sales of hardware, and most resellers depend on margin for selling boxes or box shifting. The bulk of their revenue comes from box shifting, not from delivering professional services. So if you suddenly say people still need to have networking people on staff, but how do networking people, stay skilled and stay relevant and stay trained when the only thing you're working on is a banking app?
I don't know that I'd put it as networking people, I guess. But you still have a networking function that someone's got to deal with. I mean, even if that person that maybe used to be full-time networking is now also working on the local sensor processing network. Fog still sticks in my throat, but it's such a marketing term. But yes, fog computing, if we want to call it that, fine. And there's still infrastructure there that's got to be cared for and fed. And in a larger organization, you will want someone. Maybe that person doesn't only do networking, though. They're doing other things that have been rolled into their responsibilities.
Yeah, that's right. But if you're not, how are you going to understand the details of TCP/IP or the HTTP protocol if you're a developer and your real experience is writing data on and off a message queue? How do you make the gap from no knowledge in that to expert in that?
Well, if your operations people are expert in that, do you as a developer need to be expert in that? Now, developers historically have never been experts in transport, or it's the rare one that actually understands HTTP well and TCP/IP well. Most of them don't. That's just a part of the stack that they've got libraries that access for them. They don't have a lot of knowledge there and don't really want to know. And it would come down to, in my experience over the years of dealing with development folks, they would look to me to help them troubleshoot whatever the heck it is going on. The classic, this goes back a long time, but the classic, it works great on the LAN, it's crap over the WAN. Yes, you can't bring back a SQL query that large over the WAN. That's a bad thing. You need to get a scope that brings back a much smaller data set if you expect this app to function. I don't know that I'd push back and expect development people to ever have that expertise. It's still an operations staff that does that.
I think it's also, I'm also sensitive to the fact that a lot of the times it just doesn't matter. For the first time in years, we have enough compute, enough bandwidth, and enough storage to not actually worry about it. So there is a countervailing trend, which is where once upon a time we paid so much money for compute and so much money for, a megabyte per megabyte of storage or so much money per megabit of bandwidth that we just had to make sure it was all being wisely managed. But now we've got so much of it, it just doesn't matter. And I'm a big fan of just saying buy more bandwidth because that'll solve all your networking problems.
Okay. Yep, I'm fine with that. Capacity is rarely the issue these days because there's so much of it and it's so cheap. Why wouldn't you just buy it and over-provision, right? I'm with you on that. But there is still a manage, maybe not a resource management problem exactly, but there is still a care and feeding challenge. So yes, the network has, just for sake of argument, let's call it infinite capacity, and compute has infinite capacity. Okay, but how are we slicing and dicing that now? And so security, still a big and increasingly big challenge, always been a big challenge, increasingly big. Now, because of the complexity of the infrastructure, you've got someone that needs to be very good at that. You've got a person that's going to need, as a new application comes on board, be able to understand the security paradigm that's required for the business and then put that in place. And so if 5 years ago I was the quote-unquote firewall person, maybe that falls to me now. Well, they're pretty good at security. They kind of understand this stuff. Let's put that on them. And even though it doesn't look like the old school centralized firewall with a policy, now it looks like it's a decentralized a firewall policy. And maybe it's not even stateful firewalling anymore. Now it's I'm managing access lists through some central policy manager. And I still think there's a hands-on person for that.
Yeah, well, there's certainly a review function or an auditing function that has to be done. But that auditing function can also be automated. So you can use metadata to say firewall rules are automatically derived from the, you know, this box belongs to this development, this product, which belongs to this developer. Therefore, this is the policy that it should be. This should talk to this. This should talk to this. And that's automated out.
Right, which an Illumio would do. And there's some open source projects that kind of play in that space as well. But I'm just... Who's going to deal with the Illumio box? That's the way of things, right? An enterprise buys software, it gets assigned to someone. It doesn't, they're not going to hire an engineer to bring it, set it up once, and then walk away from it. It's going to need tuning and tailoring and care and feeding, a comprehension of how it works, the ability to look at the solution and understand how it does what it does.
So today it's a permanent on-time, full-time staff member. Could it be a consultant, contractor, temporary resource?
For some businesses, I think it'll definitely be a consultant because your business will be static enough that you won't have that many changes. You'll need to call the plumber. You know, you need to call someone to come in and, you know, be your specialist and deal with stuff. But I think for
when the toilet overflows, you bring the plumber in, but not until the toilet. You don't have a plumber on staff just in case.
Or we've got an audit happening. You know, we need you to be on site for 3 days during the audit so you can, you know, answer any questions and, you know, generate some reports for us and whatever else. And then the audit's over and, you know, off they go. And that's going to be cheaper and for the business to do that rather than have the full-time person. But I think other businesses are going to be changing enough or have enough applications going on and have enough variety in what their requirements are over a period of weeks and months that they really do want to have that full-time person. And again, it's just a shift in roles and responsibilities.
It's going to depend on the criticality of the app, right? How much does this app, how much does your IT infrastructure deliver to your business? So, you know, if you're a real-time banking application or real-time trading application working on the stock exchanges and you're doing deals in, you know, millisecond-level intervals, you're always going to have somebody on staff. But you look at your average real estate agent, which has completely gotten rid of their IT functions just using Google Docs now and Google Mail for everything. You know, times change. Things change.
Well, for sure. I mean, and small businesses definitely are going to be outsourced. I mean, we're a small business. Mm-hmm. We don't have any IT staff. We don't need any. Everything we have is in the cloud, you know.
But we also run it as well. We also run the tech support that we need. We have the capability ourselves.
But even so, I mean, if you think about it, our ability to do tech support is very limited because of time. We're too busy actually doing the businessy stuff of our business to actually have time to deal with infrastructure. And so therefore, as we've had problems with RSS feeds breaking, what do? We raise a support case with the vendor.
We know enough to
help.
We also know what we're buying. We know what a computerized accounting app looks like. We know what a...
But even if we didn't, would we hire a body? No, you know, we wouldn't. We might hire a consultant from time to time if we were completely ignorant of IT. And that's kind of my point. I think small businesses, by and large, you're going to outsource it. It's going to work right 90%+ of the time. If you've got any amount of complexity to it, like we have kind of a spider web of apps and tools that deliver all of what we write and record out to everyone who's listening.
Yeah.
And so
it takes a lot of skill and a lot of IT experience to make those decisions about what you're buying and then to master them.
But still, if I'm small enough, I don't bring a body in-house. If I'm big enough, and I think this really goes to, you know, more the meat of our conversation, if I'm big enough, I have to make that call of when I want people, on staff. Now, you made a point earlier about if I'm, a high-frequency trader and I'm worried about the milliseconds and even the microseconds, do you have people on staff to maintain that infrastructure? Well, of course you do, because you can't wait for a consultant to come in, a week and a half later, because that's the first hole they had on their calendar to come and talk to your problem. You need someone that can address it right now. We have a two millisecond gap now that we didn't used to have. That's a problem. Yeah. Guys, get on it and sort out what's going on between Chicago and New York.
I think we're going to see, there will be public clouds, and there are things that make perfect sense in the public cloud, in the same way that co-location and hosting and any other outsourcing function has always made sense, and in the same way that outsourcing simple, easily measured things makes sense. So putting your computers in a co-location facility makes sense because it's easy to measure when the co-location facility is working. Is it cool and is there power?
Right.
Now that's really easy to measure that. Right? So you go and buy a colo, you want it to be reliable to a certain number of, nines at some level of guarantee. And you can measure that really easy. It's like, and this is where, again, this outsourcing metaphor where it's really easy to outsource the cleaning of toilets in your company because it's really easy to measure how successful you are at cleaning the toilets because anybody can go and look at a toilet and know if it's clean or not. It doesn't require specialist skills to be able to measure that, if you know what I'm saying.
I do. And I agree that it will always make sense to do those sorts of things, that sort of amount of outsourcing. And I guess what the case that I'm raising is that I don't think every business is going to have outsourced everything by the time this is all said and done, that everything's just going to live in public cloud. There's too many reasons you want to have local stuff. So for those people listening that are like, I'm concerned my job is going away. Your job, I know we've said this before, maybe we're beating a dead horse here. Your job's going to change. I don't think it goes away for everyone. And maybe it changes and you have to find something that's not at the company you're currently at and you got to go somewhere else. That could happen. I can see that. Mm. But I don't see on balance that the demand for IT expertise is going away. You're going to have to learn some stuff. You're going to have to skill up, maybe learn some things you didn't do before. And the networking stuff you dearly love and that CCNP you've been sitting on for the last 12 years isn't going to be valuable in the way that it once was. That knowledge will never go away, but you're going to have to get new skills to continue to maintain IT infrastructure. Knowing networking alone isn't enough. Now it's going to be, you're going to have to understand how public... You're going to have to understand how public cloud works. You're going to have to understand what it means when there's an internet backbone challenge that all of a sudden makes your infrastructure as a service between your business and the cloud start to suck and how you deal with those sorts of things. And you're going to have to understand what it means to talk to a developer and how their application is getting deployed on your infrastructure rather than just taking a ticket over the wall, doing what's asked of you and throwing the ticket back saying done and then walking away and pretending you didn't. You shouldn't have done more because you should have done more. You're going to need to get good at having real conversations with people. So again, I think things are going to change. I don't think you're going to be out of demand for work as long as you keep scaling up and not, again, relying on that 12-year-old CCNP.
Yeah, and skills are going to change, like as always. Yeah, things have always changed. Look at where we were. I was doing Novell NetWare many years ago, so... Do you know what I mean?
And so was I. I can see right now I have a book with all of my classes and certifications that I've done over the years. And the opening part of that book, Novell, NetWare 3 and NetWare 4, baby. How much of that I use today? That would be none. That would be none.
Yeah, and exactly. I know that.
Well, Greg, let's take a pause here for a minute because we want to let everyone know that we are making a public appearance in New York City at the kind of around the ONUG conference. I don't know that we're going to be actually at the ONUG conference. We may or may not be, but Viptela has asked us to show up, and I think we're putting on a live show one of the ONUG nights, right?
Yeah, it'll be on the Monday night. We're still working out some of the details, but it's a live podcast. So if you, A, live in New York or in the surrounding areas, you can come along. It's not like you have to be at the conference to come. It'll be on Monday night, the 24th, I should think. It's just, you know, we'll have the details for registration, but if you've got a calendar, get this in your thing, come and see us. If you're at the ONUG conference, you can come along. If you live in New York, you can come along. If you want to get to New York on October the 24th, then come along. We'd love to see you there. We're going to record our live podcast with Viptela. We'll be talking about SD-WAN because Viptela is about SD-WAN. And we have a lot of fun. There'll be some free beer, and you'll be able to have a chat to other people and also to meet us.
Well, I'm laughing because the last time we did a show with Viptela, I fondly remember that they tried to prime the pump by, right during the recording, putting alcohol on the table as we went. It's like, come on, guys, that's not nice.
Literally, neat alcohol shots.
Yes.
That wasn't a good look. Well, fortunately, we're grown up enough now to overcome such things.
But it will be fun. We've done a couple of these with Viptela now. It is always a good time. And what's interesting about these events is you're like, oh, it's just Viptela. It's just a marketing pitch. Well, of course, there's that element to it. You know, Viptela wants you to come and learn about them. That's part of the magic. But the other part of the magic is just the people you meet, these people that show up. It's like you run what kind of a network and you're doing what that in you just end up in all of these really interesting conversations. And so basically show up and network, meet some people, bring your business cards, talk to folks, you know, find out what people are doing, you know, make some friends, some people that you can bounce ideas and challenges off of. These mixers are great for that stuff.
Yeah. A load of fun. And do, you know, get out of your shell. Take at least one night, get out of your introverted shell like us and go around and say hello to people. So last time we had one, it was pretty good fun. It was not only was there was, you know, a few drinks and lots of laughs. People were all telling each other stories, hard nightmare stories about networking. And we also had a good show, which we got out of it and published, which was able to share, stories about real people. So Viptela has often taken a very mature approach to marketing, which is to put customers on the stage to talk about their SD-WAN experiences. Now, we're not sure what the final content's going to look like on this show, but, you know, let's just say that Viptela is not a marketing company in the old sense of the word. They're very interested in putting on a show that you want to come to. So we'd love to see you there.
So, Greg, something else that's changing, network management. So network management, we're seeing morph into, it's not good enough just to pull SNMP OIDs and make pretty graphs and then scratch our heads and wonder what's up. We are seeing now the need for a deeper understanding of how applications are delivered across the network. So yes, SNMP OID data may be valuable, but it's not by itself interesting. And we're seeing analytics is a thing, telemetry is a thing. And you know, some of our sponsors that have been on the show, SolarWinds, Pessler very recently, NetSAS also recently. They've got their own platforms, and their platforms that as network engineers, we understand and we like them. We can point them at our switches and put in the community strings and, you know, woo, we see interfaces and so on. But there's more to the story now.
Yeah, I think this is absolutely key. You can't think about monitoring, and this sort of goes back to the way that most people learn about networking. They learn about it as hop by hop. And so you think of network management as a hop by hop, right? You go down to your CCNA training or your first, and people tell you that the packet moves across the network one hop by one hop, and your router crediting protocols work by device. And so you build up this mental model of your network as a thing of devices. This, and if you're a server person coming into networking, you think about everything as a server and a server and a server. But the reality is that networking is end-to-end. And what you need to be monitoring is the end-to-end connection, not five devices in the path. And to me, this is the change from network management, which is management of devices, to network visibility, which is what is the flow doing? What is the end-to-end application performance that the network is responsible for?
Which, for the sake of the people newer in their career, that isn't to say network traffic isn't packets and then that those packets don't flow hop by hop. They do. It's just how you are perceiving. That's looking at the trees and missing the forest. If you're staring at device by device and thinking in terms of packets, you know, Greg, I think to your point, we're really talking about that forest view.
Yes. And it's even getting more complicated now as so I've been trying to read up and write some summary notes about the QUIC protocol, QUIC, which is HTTP over UDP. So instead of running HTTP over TCP, they're now talking about running it over UDP. And there's lots of great reasons as to why this actually works. One of them is because you don't have to do a three-way handshake, you can actually get connections set up in like fractional points of time. And the reason that we use TCP was because in lossy networks, having a stateful protocol meant you got better throughput. But we have a lot more bandwidth now. Networks effectively loss less. It's the exception, not the rule, that packets will drop. So HTTP over UDP makes a hell of a lot more sense. If you're going to start monitoring sessions, today we can monitor flows, like TCP flows, because we can, you know, see the session set up, and then we can say, well, this is a flow from here to here, and I can get a flow record. Matching that into UDP is very hard. And all of a sudden, things are going to be very, very different. And how are you going to cope with that if protocols continue to change or DNS disappears is what the other one that's happening?
Well, I think what you're getting to here is a new class of visibility tools that are ingesting data in a couple of different ways to present to us that end-to-end paradigm, whether it's, you know, QUIC, HTTP over UDP, or something else that can break that down. We've had a number of vendors begin talking to us about streaming telemetry. You know, that is to say, you are not with your network management system reaching out with SNMP, pulling OIDs, getting data back, and then graphing them. Rather, it's the flip side. It's push. The switch is gathering some amount of data and pushing it into a system that can parse that data. It's not SNMP. It's some other kind of a format, whatever it might be. And then that data gets munged by a platform that can handle that telemetry. And the data you're getting tends to be, it's some of the boring stuff like fan and temperature, you know, the environmental things that you do need to know. But it's also, you can get full flow data out of that now. You can get full routing table states out of that now. And then you can aggregate all of that data and get that end-to-end picture by gathering all of that streaming telemetry and painting a picture of what application delivery looks like end to end. And so we've had, I'm trying to think of some other sponsors we had on that are kind of in this world. Kentik, certainly, the BGP focused at the moment, but gathering all kinds of data from all sorts of sources and presenting you end to end source of information. And then Deepfield as well.
And how do we do that, right? What happens in the cloud? So you've got to start thinking about how do you start, and if your end-to-end starts in the public cloud and finishes in a private cloud, or worse, what if it starts in a smartphone and ends up in a public cloud and doesn't cross your private network at all? What does your network visibility look like then? And do you have, so then logically, do you have one system for public clouds and one system for private clouds? And then what if things move between the public and the private, or you want them to go from private to public? How do you then correlate the things between them?
Or what if you're trying to go back in time and you have an ephemeral infrastructure where, you know, containers stood up to handle a burst of requests and then get stood back down, and that was 3 hours ago, and you've now found out there was a problem with transaction latency and you need to go and research that. How in the heck are you going to figure out the application flow when you have ephemeral infrastructure that changes on an hourly basis and don't know what it was? You need something that can gather all that information up for you and have a point in time presentation of what things looked like. And, you know, so to speak to your, you know, what happens when it's a phone that is querying something that's in the public cloud and you didn't actually have anything in the middle of that data stream. How do you do that? And I think this is where, say you were a VMware NSX shop. Well, they bought Arkinet. Okay, Arkin can visualize your workloads, the security rules that are impacting those workloads, and then give you the VXLAN encapsulation that might be involved in those, and give you all of that end to end. So we'd be assuming that there'd be some sort of NSX in the cloud there, you know, on one end of that workload. So you do have some visibility somewhere. You can't just see things that you have nothing. You got to have something in the path somewhere, right? Or have data coming off those boxes to some central point. But it's just a very different way to think about how your network is delivering traffic, and where all of those resources are going from and to, as opposed to SNMP querying our switches and our routers and our firewalls, et cetera, and we kind of know where all of those things are.
My point is that where's the monitoring point for your visibility? In networking, we've always relied on the network itself to do the visibility. But there's a couple of things. One is the move to encryption, which means if you want to decrypt apps to get real visibility into the application to measure it, you've got to have the private key, which you may not have, right? Because managing private keys is like buku hard. And the second one is exactly why, where in the network are you going to put something so that it can get that data? Like, let's just forget apps and functionalities and now analytics and machine learning and artificial intelligence. Just where the heck is the data source going to come from?
Well, I think part of it is we are seeing the devices that are in the middle of a certain, okay, SD-WAN, for example. So we know Viptela and CloudGenix and a number of other systems here that do SD-WAN. What is one of their key value propositions? Well, it's that they have deep analytics of the traffic that's flowing through them. You know, you look at CloudGenix box, and it will tell you all of the different apps. It's going to classify all the apps that are flowing through that and show them to you. Mm-hmm. And so part of the answer to that question, Greg, where are we going to see, I think, is that we're seeing systems that do other things that we wouldn't normally think of as being, you know, analytics devices or, you know, monitoring devices, et cetera. We are seeing those devices come with built-in analytics as part of the package. Again, going back to NSX with Arkin, you know, you buy the Arkin add-on, still a separate SKU, last I knew, for NSX, you get all of this visibility that Arkin pulls out of the system for you, pulls out of the VMware system for you and presents all that data to you. You know, CloudGenix, Viptela, and some of these other ones, you get reporting because they happen to be in the middle of a particular traffic flow and have this rich reporting capability. You're not relying on a separate NMS to gather and present that data for you. It's built into something that is doing something else for you.
Yeah. And what I want to, and the thing to think here is, how do you then think about how different that is from the network that you probably operate today? If you're actually talking about using virtual appliances in the cloud to do your data collection for your visibility, and once you've got the data collection, how are you then going to mine that data for useful information? So, you know, how are you going to analyze application response time in that environment? And for what use case? What is an application response time? In the old days, we used to measure things like HTTP. How long does it take for a HTTP get response to go through, and then call that application response? But in the cloud, it's all very different. What happens with a WebSockets when you've got a proprietary, you know, JSON encapsulation running across a WebSocket session that your developers wrote themselves? Define application response.
Well. So I think a point you're making here is that it gets, you know, the traditional metrics that we've looked at aren't necessarily going to be true, or they're going to be, you know, the concerns that we have are going to be a little bit different. But being able to quantify and articulate a specific application response time is sort of, you know, key, and is, I don't know that it's that far different from APM, which we've been doing for a long time now, you know, better as we go. I don't know that it's that much different, but certainly the decentralization of IT makes that a little bit harder, you know, and a little bit more, you know, thoughtful, you know, how you're doing it and the questions that you need to be asking of your infrastructure, because your infrastructure is no longer simply the thing in the noisy room over there on the other side of the locked door that you need to clear the bio reader to get into. It's now stuff living everywhere, and then quantifying those responses and truly understanding. For example, if you've got a multi-layered transaction of, you know, authentication and then a web call and then a database call and then a reporting action that goes back to a database that's then web and then, you know, back to you, you understand how that application was architected at every layer, where authentication lives, whether it's local or in the cloud, or a mixture of the two, where the web calls are being done, the databases, where that's being done. And it, again, not different thinking from the APM world. If you really put a lot of time into your APM monitoring and truly built a proper monitoring stack, but now being able to monitor stuff that you've never seen before, and then having a very concrete idea of what all that looks like. But again, I want to go back to the point of maybe your NMS provider isn't necessarily where you have to go for that, because there's other SDN platforms that have this built in, or orchestration platforms that have this built in. I'm reminded of Anuda, you know, that just came on board. There's some amount of visibility that's there within the Anuda platform, which we think of for provisioning, right? You have a catalog of services that you build up. You request something from that catalog. The platform automatically stands up what you need in response to your request. And now you've got some element of functionality or of reporting.
There's no reason your provisioning can't include monitoring and telemetry, you know. And there are tools like, you know, New Relic and so forth, which actually embed the monitoring and include the networking monitoring inside of the application itself. So you embed agents inside the software, and it actually works that way. So, yeah.
Well, folks, Greg and I have waffled on for enough today. We've kicked around. This is one of those shows because, you know, as Greg and I do our research and reading and look at the new technologies that are being consumed by enterprises, we're like, what the heck does this mean for networking? And it's been hard, you know, because it's not always a straightforward answer. And there's so many things in motion, et cetera. But we care about this stuff. This is important to us, you know, trying to pick out as all these trends are going on, what's real, what's not, what are people doing with them, what problems are being solved, what the cost models are, if those add up, and then what that means to those of us who have been building networks for the last 20 years. That's a big concern. That's why we kick these things around. You're like, guys, this was not a networking show. No, not exactly, but but it's what we think networking is slowly morphing into.
Yeah, well, you know, my point, Ethan, is, you know, we have the Human Infrastructure Magazine, which we talk about the human component, and you know, what are our jobs going to look like? You know, what are we as humans going to look like in the years ahead? Have you ever wondered?
Exactly. You know,
I don't know. I mean, the thing about the cloud is that everything in the cloud is in the cloud. So, you know, everything's going to change, or maybe nothing. I actually increasingly think that the cloud is only going to be a small part of the overall computing, but where we work may not be in traditional enterprises doing office support like we do today.
Well, for all of you out there, thanks for listening to Packet Pushers today. You can find this, many more fine free technical podcasts, along with our community blog, is at packetpushers.net. Follow us on Twitter at Packet Pushers. You can find us on LinkedIn, like us on Facebook, rate us on iTunes, please. We would really appreciate that. Last but not least, remember that too much technology would never be enough.